Stay tuned for Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah, featuring two film critics with distinctly different tastes in movies, Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net. He thinks her tastes are shallow. She thinks his are pretentious. Listen in as they discuss and debate new releases and other film-related topics. Let the clash begin.
Hello and welcome to the Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com.
And I'm Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net.
Hannah, I nailed the wine tonight.
We've
had good matches before, but this one, out of the park.
Oh my goodness, it is a Mamma Mia red blend. I am shocked that I went looking and I found this disgusting looking wine that was called like Mama Mango. And then I messaged you and I'm like, do I get this disgusting wine? And you said, no, I should go with the food choice that I brought. But what does it say about Mamma Mia wine?
Product of Italy.
It should be Greece.
And yeah. Well, actually, I was thinking about that. We'll get to that, about why it should probably not be Greece. But what did you bring?
I brought candy, and it goes so well with the wine.
Abba Zabba.
It's called
Abba Zabba. Abba
Zabba. It is chewy taffy with a peanut butter center that looks like it's been around for a while. But hey, it was on sale. And
yeah, it says soft and chewy. There's nothing soft about
this. It says soft and chewy, but it doesn't appear to be all that soft and chewy. But come on, anything that has ABBA in the name of the candy, I figured it was a sure bet. So it goes very well with the Mamma Mia wine.
Well, let's just pat ourselves on the back.
Yeah, good
on us. We're talking about 6 films tonight. We each saw 5 of them. And we might as well start with what will be the biggest movie of the week. It will win the box office. It's not in the most theaters. The second film actually has slightly more theaters. But we are going to talk about Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again. My, my. How did I ever let you go?
I don't know how you came up with that, Charlie.
So in 2008, 10 years ago, they released the first Mamma Mia. And naturally, I didn't like it. And it's not, I don't know if it was because of the film or just because of me, probably because of me. Because I saw the play. I saw the musical in London, in the West End, on a stage. It was awesome. I was pumped. And then they made a movie out of it, and I was not pumped. I didn't like it. It was overacted. It was badly sung. I hated everything about it. Just didn't like it. So you saw how thrilled I was the other night to be in the audience. Oh, great. Mamma Mia. Here we go again.
Yeah, you looked like you were in pain at the beginning there.
And I liked it.
I know.
I liked it.
I could tell. I'll tell you, when they kicked into Waterloo, I saw a little grin spread across Charlie's face.
I did not like it because of all the characters we already know, because I already don't like them, and I still don't like them. Looking at you, Pierce Brosnan.
Oh, I love Pierce Brosnan.
And Amanda
Brosnan.
Seyfried.
Yeah.
I like Lily James.
You've always liked Lily James.
She's probably 60% of the film. This film is present day. Well, actually, by the math, it's not present day. It's like 2008.
Well, yeah.
But, and it's also 1979. Remember in the first film, we don't know who Dada is? It could be one of the three gentlemen. Because Mama, Donna, played by Meryl Streep, kind of one night stood her way across Europe to get to this Greek isle. And now we're jumping back to 1979 to watch her jump from paramour to paramour. And that's the best part of the film, because Lily James is magnetic.
She is. I mean, she's really good. I loved her in like Baby Driver, and she was actually Cinderella. You know, I had to go back and look at that one, and then when I remembered, you know, that really was one of the first times that I think I'd really noticed her on the screen. And I think other people know her from Downton Abbey, but was she in Downton Abbey? Am I getting her mixed up with someone else? I'm not sure.
You might be getting her mixed up with someone else.
I might be.
She's British, but...
But I really I thought she was fantastic, and she just had this just engaging personality on screen when she breaks into song and dance. She's just a lot stronger, I think, on screen than like Amanda Seyfried is as Sophie. She does in fact carry this movie.
Oh, single-handedly. The movie kicks off in absurdity. They start with When I Kissed the Teacher, and she's graduating from Oxford, which we didn't think Donna would have graduated from Oxford. It looks like she's the valedictorian. And they did an interesting, I didn't notice this until today. She changed the pronouns. Kind of this LGBT wink. She changed the pronouns to When I Kissed the Teacher to a woman.
And I didn't catch that, but I'll tell you that
song. I may or may not have been listening to the soundtrack today.
Well, and that song has been that is like the total earworm for me of the week, is that that's the one song of ABBA's that I really was not familiar with. And then I went and found a clip on YouTube, and now that song is just running through my head. But it does. It kicks off the fun part of this film. And yes, Meryl Streep comes in briefly.
Spoiler alert, yeah. I'm not talking about Meryl Streep.
But she does make an appearance, as does Cher, as Donna's mother.
They do an interesting thing with Cher. Fernando is one of ABBA's most probably famous song and maybe most widely mocked song because it's just so odd. They're talking about
Fernando.
You know, there's something in the air that night, right? And the way they shoehorn that song in and make the script fit the lyrics, mm-hmm. and that's an ironclad rule of Mamma Mia. You have to make the script A fit the lyrics, and B, by the end, everyone has to pair off. Like with a love interest, everybody. And I don't know, there's just something there's something just so, okay, you got me. You got me.
I mean, and Cher is there as that showstopper scene stealing moment near the end.
I was less impressed with Cher than you.
No, I wasn't so impressed. I was less impressed than I expected to be, actually. Only more because she just looked like a statue.
Yeah, she didn't even move.
It's like she does not move in her scene. And whereas when Meryl Streep is on screen, there's more to it. It's more emotional. With Cher, it's really more of a cheese factor that you embrace it and you're kind of, you're waiting for it. And it's fine. But what I like, too, is Pierce Brosnan, they do not make him sing much in this film, which is smart.
He does an homage to the song he destroyed,
SOS. And the other two guys, Colin Firth and
Stellan Skarsgård.
Skarsgård are back briefly. And the younger versions of them are
interchangeable.
I wouldn't have known which one was which.
Don't care.
Really hard. You don't really care. The whole point is that you get the idea. You understand why any one of these three guys, all with good hearts, could potentially be Sophie's dad.
I actually saw what the producers did an interview, and I saw which dad they actually said is the dad. I don't think I should say who it is.
If I had to make a guess, I would say, or I would hope it was the Pierce Brosnan character.
I don't know if you want me to tell you or not.
Don't know.
Like, they don't know, but the producers say
they envision?
It's Bill, Stellan Skarsgård.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah.
That's weird. That would be my least favorite option of those three. But the whole point of the story is it doesn't really matter.
No, she wants to play my three dads.
Because especially now, just you'd send it to Ancestry 23 and you'd know
You'd know pretty quick.
You'd know fast.
Well, and the original director's gone. Phyllida Lloyd, after Mamma Mia, she went to The Iron Lady, stuck with Meryl Streep, and then she really hasn't done much since. So they brought in kind of a relative new director, but he's been around a while, Ol Parker. He wrote your favorite, I don't know if they're your favorite, I'm just saying they're your favorite, Best Exotic Marigold Hotel scripts.
Yeah.
And so they brought him on to do this, and
it looks like that.
The reason why I said this probably shouldn't be Greek wine is because I don't think that's a Greek isle.
They did shoot it on the Greek island.
It looks like CGI.
No, they did. They actually, I saw the name of this Greek island. No, that was the whole point. They got this great trip.
I don't know.
Oh, yeah, no. They've all been marketing.
It does not look like
it. But that was the beauty of it, is it's this beautiful locale that they all got to go and party on while shooting this film. And I think that's also why you see them having so much fun making this. It really doesn't matter the fact that the first the first three quarters of the film are kind of cheesy and lame.
Well, it's all cheesy, all of it.
No, but see, I found a part of the final 15 minutes, though, to redeem.
You like the weepy part.
Mm. I like the weepy part, and
because people were straight up crying.
And I love the closing credits. It's like
They did it again.
It's smart because you leave with a smile on your face, no matter how you felt. Up until the last 10 minutes of this film, it would be hard. I'd be hard pressed to find anyone who did not leave that film at least thinking, that was cute. I'm happier than I was when I walked in. It met my expectations. I'm surprised you didn't like the first one, because I think it'll just be interesting to see how people who love the first one rate this one.
I think this has already a higher tomato meter.
And I watched a sing-along version that they aired on broadcast television last week as a bit of a refresher for me, because I did not remember many details of the original. And so that, to me, helped set up watching this one. And I think this one is slightly better. But the first one just had that original streak where, unless you had the honor of seeing the stage version in the West End before everyone else did,
naturally,
then perhaps, you know, you'd view the first film differently. But for those who saw the stage film after they saw the movie, because they just fell in love with how these songs are just shoehorned into a story, then it's all good. And I think this one should satisfy the fans of the original.
Yeah, I don't think anyone's going to walk out of there in a bad mood.
No.
The next wide release, the one that's actually opening in more theaters than Mamma Mia, you didn't see, but I went to see, because I loved the first one. I loved The Equalizer. It was so good. It was this refresh action thriller genre, and Denzel killing people with corkscrews.
Oh, and, what fun.
How's this for a transition? I'm going to do a nice factoid for a transition. Both Meryl Streep and Denzel Washington have had very long and distinguished careers. Mm-hmm. And this weekend, they're both starring in their first sequel. Meryl Streep's never been in a sequel until Mamma Mia 2.
Wow.
Denzel's never been in a sequel until The Equalizer 2. The reason I'm so disappointed is that The Equalizer 2 is just a shadow. It's just a shadow of the first one. It's an echo. Everything about what was awesome about The Equalizer is not awesome about The Equalizer 2.
But it's Denzel.
It is Denzel. And I'm okay. I didn't pan it, but I didn't like it. In the first one, you know, he's already retired as a government assassin. He's working like at Home Depot. Hence, the big climax is him killing people in Home Depot with like hammers and screws and stuff. Now he's a Lyft driver. And I hope Lyft paid a bunch of money, because they are getting crazy advertising. And we just watched kind of Denzel drive around Boston, helping people. Because now he's equalizing. He's helping people. There's the frat bros who put a lady in the back of his Lyft, and they had done something to this lady. So he goes and visits them and make sure they'll probably walk with a limp for the rest of their lives. Mm-hmm. But make sure you rate me 5 stars or I'm coming back.
I was going to say, next time they're taking Uber.
And, you know, he's just helping people because he's got sin on his shoulders. He did some bad stuff in his government assassinating days. Of course, one of his good friends gets murdered, therefore I have to avenge you. But we won't get to that until the climax. When I need a climax, I'll come and get to that, and we'll fight some heavily armed mercenaries in the middle of a Category 5 hurricane outside on the beach. You know, it's so over the top. And he's back with director Antoine Fuqua. Oh. You know, this is their fourth time together. And this, you know, he did the first Equalizer, and they'd done some pretty good action movies together in the past. And I don't know, this one, the script is just meh. The script writer did the first film, so they didn't bring in a new script writer. And I don't know, did they not put the extra elbow grease into it? Did they think they could just ride on the strength of the first one? Maybe they thought this one would just be as good. I don't know. But, what a waste.
Well, I think it will ride on the strength of the first one. I've heard from a few folks who've seen it, and they enjoyed it. They also agree with you that there was nothing great about it, and it was not as good as the first one. But they didn't not like it. And so it sounds like that's kind of how folks are coming out of that one. I would have liked to see it, maybe because I do like Denzel Washington, but I did not see the first Equalizer, and the timing didn't really work out to see this one. And I don't like anything that's usually just described as hyperviolent in the little blurb. And so I was ready for a break from hyperviolent.
Well, he uses a gun this time. That's very un-Equalizer. I mean, not the whole time, because he still, like, kills a guy with a teapot but and a credit card. But, he actually uses a firearm this time. And, you know, maybe he had to in the situation. But, that got away from it a little bit. And, I don't know, just, I think it's an opportunity lost. I didn't hate it, didn't like it. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. I'm just so disappointed.
Oh, well, that's why there's so many other things to choose from this week.
Break. We're about to get to a movie that knocked both our socks off. Eighth Grade. A movie you should identify with, and I should not identify with.
I disagree, but we'll get to that.
I felt being the trauma of being a 13-year-old wallflower of a girl when Kayla, starring Elsie Fisher, we'll get to Elsie Fisher, is at a pool party she's not really invited to, but she was forced to be invited to, walks out into the pool. She's in her one piece, and she's, I don't know, she's not fat, not at all, but she's a little bit more average than the rest of the petite skinny minis wearing bikinis. And when she walks out petrified out of the screen door over to the pool, it's like, I've never been so nervous in my entire life. Yeah. And that is because of it's absolute amazing direction. Bo Burnham, 27-year-old.
Yeah, I know.
Bo Burnham. He's actually a stand-up comic and has only directed like comedy specials before this. This is his feature film debut. And he made me, a crusty old 37-year-old Caucasian male with a mortgage and a cat, care and identify with this 13-year-old Instagram addict.
Yeah, I think that it is a movie that is made for any 13 to 15-year-old girl to go see. They will identify with it. You know, this Kayla character, well, Elsie Fisher can relate to this character. She was exactly the age of her character. So I think it definitely helped that you didn't have some like 22-year-old trying to play a 14-year-old, which sometimes happens. And so it's so authentic and real. It feels almost like a documentary when it starts. It's like this poor girl. It exposes all the angst and body shaming issues and fears and anticipation of being somebody about to enter high school in that transitional period. And she, in the privacy of her own room, when she's doing these sort of self-help YouTube videos, she has all this confidence. And, you know, so you know it's in there somewhere. And she's a good kid. And so I think one of the reasons that this film is good for, even though it's rated R, parents should go with their kids. There's plenty for them to sort of talk about. And I would say it's like PG-13 plus.
Well, yeah, they get into something like she researches something.
Right, but it's that one thing.
Those
other
girls,
than that.
14-year-old girls already know what that is anyway.
Yeah, it's there was a 14-year-old girl in the theater. She said that this movie was so spot on that she just loved it. The moms were squirming their hearts out. It was so painful for the parents in the audience to actually see this. I spoke last night to our buddy Christian Hamaker about this film. He was not enamored by it at all. He is in the minority. He does not want to go see it with his 14-year-old daughter.
And I'm on his side. I don't have a daughter, but I certainly wouldn't want to see it with my daughter either.
And so I can understand that. I think it's more for mothers and daughters to maybe see together, and otherwise let the teenagers go see it. Don't be put off by the R rating, because this is just a very poignant, sweet, true, authentic feeling.
Well, she is authentic. And when she does those YouTube videos, like, her main theme is be yourself. Mm-hmm. Just be who you are. And she's hypocritical. She's not herself in those videos.
Right.
She's actually a very shy person. She wins that award most quiet, and it just petrifies her. She has a hard time talking to her peers. She stutters and is so embarrassed. And yeah, it's very hypocritical to get up there and do those YouTube videos, which no one's watching anyway.
Yeah.
But I like the relationship between her and her single father.
Mm-hmm.
They're at the dinner table, and she's got her earbuds in.
Yeah, that's right.
And she's acting like he's the annoying guy because he wants to talk.
That's right.
She's like, you promised I could be on my phone. I don't know if Bo Burnham's trying to make a statement about screen addiction or, you know, how many hours a day kids spend on the phone. She spends a lot of time on her phone, and I think 13-year-old girls do.
They do. We did with landlines. Back when I was 13, it was you were on the landline, and I remember being really embarrassed, like when my father would pick up the phone, there was no there was no call waiting or whatever, and there was only one phone for the household, and I'd be talking to some friend of mine for 2 hours, and I'd suddenly hear my parents get on the extension and just be like, get off the phone.
But I don't really think there's a message in here, like a warning, you're spending too much time on your phone.
No, I think it's an acknowledgement that's just the current, that the technology of today, it's the same kind of thing that's been going on with teenagers since the beginning of time. It's just that the technology is so much a part of their lives today. And so I think the message is simply we acknowledge that these kids are really just hard to dislodge from their devices, and where we might have gone around with a 16 millimeter camera, you know, they've got their YouTube channels and subscriptions to various things, and they film everything and can take pictures instantaneously. And that just makes things sometimes even more difficult than they might otherwise have been for them.
And I just wanted to protect her. Mm-hmm. You know, at the end, she gets put in a situation that she doesn't realize what it is. And we all in the audience are going, you need to get out of there. Mm-hmm. We can see a mile down the road where this is going. And she kind of picks up on it by the end, but she's so naive. And you just want to protect her. And we're going to hear more about eighth grade throughout the year. Elsie Fisher is going to be in some conversations. So will Bo Burnham, and so will his screenplay. This is I think this is an A24 film. This is going to be talked about.
I would, if I hadn't seen the next film I'm going to talk about, I would say that it would, but it might get a little lost.
All right, I did not see our next film, and immediately after you saw it, it's like, I can't believe you didn't see this film. This film's right up your alley.
And you are going to have to see it before award season.
Tell me about Blind Spotting.
So Blind Spotting was one of those ones that I was really surprised at how much I liked it. It was co-written and co-starring these two guys, David Diggs and Rafael Kasahi, who they both are very popular with the spoken word, the verse. They actually met as teenagers in Oakland, California at a poetry jam. So that'll tell you just what their background is. And they sort of use their background, their experiences to develop this script that is very much a very timely film in terms of gentrification racial profiling. And it was it's just one you're going to hear about. It's one of those dark horses that absolutely...
I love a good dark horse.
It deserves to be out there and to be seen. I liked it. It takes place in Oakland, just like that Sorry to Bother You.
I was about to bring that up because two weeks ago, we just saw a film that you can kind of describe as racial profiling a little bit in Oakland.
Oakland. There are a lot of the same themes in both of those films, but I liked Blind Spotting way more than Sorry to Bother You.
It'd be tough to like a film more than Sorry to Bother You for me, because I really did like
that
movie.
Think you would, but I do think this one's better, and I also hope it doesn't get buried by the future one coming out in a few weeks, Black Klansman from Spike Lee, which also shares some of the same general themes. And so Blind Spotting hopefully won't get too lost in the mix. But I met both of those guys at a screening and Q&A in Baltimore last week, and I was so glad that I happened to just go and be able to see this film. And it was edited by a former coworker of mine, Gabe Fleming. And so it's like, go Gabe. You know, it's like he's doing really well. And this is just a very strong, it's humorous and poignant and brutal. And it's got a whole bunch of things going for it.
I like poignant and brutal.
I know. I really was just so thinking you needed to be seeing this movie. And eventually, you know, essentially you've got David Diggs plays this guy named Colin who's got 3 days left in his probation period. And so he just needs to make it through those next 3 days without getting into trouble.
It sounds like Ant-Man.
It reminded me a little of that Ant-Man subplot with I got to get back to the house before the authorities discover I'm gone. But with this one, he... while he's racing back to beat curfew for his probation, he witnesses a cop shooting in Oakland. And he kind of has to keep this to himself, what he witnessed, because he basically is like, I can't exactly call the cops and say, hey, I saw another cop kill somebody. And because it would have jeopardized potentially his own freedom. And so the film explores his relationship with his white working class buddy, who is really the troublemaker and not necessarily the best influence on Colin. And it explores their friendship, the boundaries of their friendship, and issues of race and class in this gentrified neighborhood where they, you know, show this juxtaposition of where you have the Whole Foods is sprouting up right next to, you know, the little corner store. And there's the good and the bad of that kind of change. And it's a tale of two Oaklands. And it's a bit of a love letter to their hometown of Oakland. It's just a very, it presents a very powerful message and is just a really solid film that hopefully people will go seek out and watch.
It's getting buzz. I think it's people will buzz. Seek it up. Eighth grade, I think, is getting more buzz.
I don't think so. I think it's going to shift.
Ooh, I don't know.
I don't know. I really think that the shift...
We might have to do a long-term bet on this one.
We might have to, because I think that that eighth grade will eventually just kind of go the way of a lot of these just really good little indies.
Well, a lot of people say the eighth grade is this year's Lady Bird. And yeah. I liked eighth grade way more than Lady Bird.
I didn't like it more, but I mean, I definitely, I can see how that could be the comparison. It's amazing for July that we've got all these films that we would think about for potential, you know, award season buzz. And so whether or not some of them can survive while all this other stuff rolls out over the next few months, we'll see.
There's also an echo of the year's earlier greatest film, Isle of Dogs, was released on DVD this week.
Yeah.
So, yeah, July, baby.
It's amazing. And I did note for my personal list of youth performances for our list at the end of the year, Elsie Fisher's on there.
Fisher's already on my youth performance list. She's also on my best actress list.
She's not on my best actress list because she is playing herself.
Gucci.
she's playing a version of.
She really nails those.
She does, but that's
YouTube videos,
of course, because that is her life. That is what they grew up in. And so I don't think it's such a stretch. I think she is.
It's not a stretch for Gary Oldman to play Churchill.
It's more of a stretch, but it's very well cast. It's a good script. It's another. I mean that's what makes it so hard. When you've got a week where you have these big studio releases like a Mamma Mia and an Equalizer 2, having to, you know, that really drown out these really good smaller films that deserve to be seen. And so I do think it's important to say, hey, eighth grade is out there. It's a really good choice if you've got a teenager or if you are sending your teen to a movie, then it's certainly not exactly like going to send them to Animal House or Ridgemont High. It's a much more...
No, it's not...
It's a...
I heard them... I saw them describe it as, oh, the comedy eighth grade.
No,
I don't remember
laughing.
It's
not a comedy.
I did not laugh.
Yeah, but that just did... Blindspotting was listed as sort of a comedy drama as well. And so that seems to be the only label that folks have been able to put on these films where... They're dramas, but they're not so heavy. They've got light moments. There's humor infused in them. And so that's not how I would define a comedy. So it is a tough one because both Eighth Grade and Blindspotting both have elements that they give it the comedy label, but they are at their core, they're dramas.
All right, since we have six films this week, at least one of them has to be a documentary. Some weeks, three of them would be documentaries. But we only have one documentary this week. And we actually talked about it a bit at the AFI Film Festival, because that's where we saw it. Dark Money. And I think that was actually my favorite documentary at that film festival. Directed by Kimberly Reed. It was nominated for the Grand Jury Prize at this year's Sundance. And it's about something as thrilling as campaign finance. One of my favorite, I just saw this one-line review. The guy didn't write a full review, just a one-liner. It says, I wonder if this political documentary will be depressing.
Yes.
The first line of the movie is, the number of dead geese is higher than we thought. And it's about dark money contributions made possible by the Supreme Court's Citizen United decision flooded modern American elections. And this is about specifically how Montana is fighting back and investigative journalism, you know, taking to task and actually following closely corrupt members of the Montana legislature, taking in all this money, who it turns out from it's the anti-union folks, the Koch brothers, and how just the dumb luck, like they have in exposing the skullduggery and the, you know, it turns out crimes, because they're not supposed to coordinate with these super PACs, and they are straight up in bed with these super PACs. And it's startling, the amount of corruption and greed. And it sounds dry, but it's actually just made me mad.
I thought it was dry. It was dry. It was drier than this wine, that's for sure. I did not like Dark... I mean, I didn't I didn't hate it.
You're about to say I didn't not like it?
I did not like it, yeah. I meant to say. but no, I really found it. It was just not among my favorites at all at the AFI docs. And it's more the same reaction that I had. Was it last week that we talked about The King, that Elvis documentary?
The best documentary of the year.
This one, I had the same issue with it in that it's depressing.
So what?
It's more of the same on how we're all getting hoodwinked.
Documentaries are not supposed to be Mamma Mia.
And we're all getting manipulated.
We are.
But it's the same. But it's like watching, talk about your sequels. This just feels like all we're seeing is yet another example of this depressing state of our world.
But it's through a lens we never see.
And, you know, how there are these corrupt corporations and politicians and... It's just one of those things, though, where, again, there's too much other really good
stuff.
This
isn't your standard, they're polluting the water corporate corruption. This is, they're polluting your elections with their dirty money.
No, and so there's, exactly, pick your poison of the week, that your food poison, you know, talk about poison, what was the eating animals? So it's just they're all kind of that same... I understand that they're exposing a real problem, and I applaud the filmmakers for getting out there and revealing the stories and trying to make a difference. But I think at this point, nobody's paying attention anymore unless they're already on the side of the filmmakers.
I'm surprised at you. I really am.
I know, but mm-hmm. I was. It's just been. This is just not one of the ones that grabbed me. So when I see one that I really, really like and that manages to uncover a story in a much more compelling way, you know, this one just doesn't grab me. When I think of a documentary, you know, and I think about something like RBG and Three Identical Strangers that we saw recently, you know, the documentaries that were very interesting and absorbing to me while still revealing a good story, a good character, a good message. Dark Money just didn't to me. I just felt that it was no different than that other one we saw about China. What was that one recently?
I remember, I didn't even remember the title. Yeah, but I knew that was a throwaway one, but... I liked Dark Money better than Three Identical Strangers.
No,
Three
not
Identical
even
Strangers
close.
Revealed something. You're absolutely right. And then it beat it to death.
Oh, I disagree.
Dark Money reveals something, and then it sticks with it, examining it from angle here, angle there, and angle over there.
But I was never all that interested. It just did not... It didn't do it for me.
Well, you didn't
and
major
so
in political science.
I did not. No, I did minor in political science. But I did, you know, journalism. And so I appreciate what's happening with some of these documentaries. This one didn't resonate with me. Some of them do more than others. And this didn't make my top list at AFI Docs. And it doesn't make my top list of... thing. I just can't imagine saying of all these films that we're talking about this week, other than the next one that we're going to talk about, I cannot imagine telling anybody this is the one you need to go seek out.
Oh, it's not. It's I have to think about that. Dark Money might be my favorite film of the week. But
you've got to be kidding. That's because you didn't see Blindspotting.
You're right. Eighth Grade is my favorite film.
And Blindspotting would have been if you'd seen it.
Speaking of, Dark Money is not the worst film of the week. It's not. That, by far, easily, the worst film of the week is called Gauguin, Voyage to Tahiti. Now, no, there are... The genre of film that is made most nowadays is the fashion documentary. There will be no films more, you know, made more than recently about the fashion documentary. But right up there, close second, I think, are French painters.
Struggling, starving, posthumously noted.
So we're talking about... Paul Gauguin. Paul Gauguin.
Paul Gauguin.
He's living in Paris. It's the Belle Époque. We're talking Moulin Rouge. And he hates it. He feels shut off. It's claustrophobic. He thinks Paris stinks. There's nothing to paint here. I need to get out. I need to breathe. But he's only thinking about himself. He is a selfish dude. He is married. He has 5 kids. And he wants to uproot them all and says, let's go to this fabled land called Tahiti. You don't get farther away from Paris, France in 1893. Then a place called Tahiti. But you know what? He just up and goes. No friends, no family, no money. And that's a big motif here. No money, and he goes to Tahiti, and he should not be there. He cannot live off the land. He cannot support himself. He's miserable, and he treats everyone around him miserable, and he treats himself miserable, and we all feel miserable in this miserable film.
Right, and he was miserable in Paris, and he was miserable in Tahiti until he meets his muse.
Tahura. He meets Tahura. And he's like, all right, let's get married. Fine. I've known you for 15 minutes.
That's right. And I'm married to somebody else, but that's okay.
I want to paint you. And when something bad happens to you, I don't want to run over there and help you. I want to sit down and paint you. Gauguin switches. It switches from, I want to go over here and paint, to a soap opera, to an adultery jealousy. And actually, it got worse. It turns into an adultery jealousy quagmire of garbage.
Yeah, I just didn't like it either.
Were we supposed to gain an appreciation for this man?
I think we were, and it wasn't the only appreciation came at the very end in the credits while you were actually looking at his art. So when they showed pictures of his paintings, and I think they did a really good job casting Tahura, because when you look at those paintings and you look at who they cast, there really is a very strong resemblance.
Looks like her.
Does look like her. I think there is a art history group of people that maybe like to watch, you know, if you really saw Loving Vincent, and I did not like this one nearly as much as Cézanne et moi.
And I didn't like that one either.
I liked Cézanne et moi last year. So I guess if you're just kind of ticking through your struggling French artist from the 1800s and early 1900s, then you can add this one to your list. But I can't imagine. It's an arty. It is truly an arty movie. It's an art house flick. It is not going to appeal to anyone who does not have the level of art appreciation to factor into their viewing of this movie. And if they are just really curious for more backstory on Paul Gauguin.
Director Edouard Deluc, he paints Gauguin as like Rapunzel's wicked kidnapper. And it makes me like the art less now that I know more about this guy.
You know what'll make you even like it less? I found out that Tahura really was like 13.
Oh.
So they just not play it as a 13-year-old teenager in this
film.
So
he married Kayla from 8th grade, and he locked her up in a tower.
Oh, gross.
And, oh, man. I was looking at the paintings just like you were in the credits, and I was like, great, now that I know about this guy, I'm looking at these paintings like I already loathe them, because he's a loathsome character.
It's just all these, you know, you talked about the over abundance of the fashion documentaries and the recent abundance of these stories about these painters, because I had just seen the one with Armie Hammer recently.
Final Portrait,
yes, very good. And and I liked Final Portrait, again, way better than Gauguin. So if you're going to go see any of these artiste movies, that would be my ranking. Like Final Portrait, Cézanne et moi. I heard Loving Vincent was beautifully shot. Like, it was really pretty. So maybe I'll see that at some point. But then Gauguin kind of falls to the bottom of the sea in this one.
Yeah, Loving Vincent's just way better than this. But that was more of a mystery, almost like a whodunit. But
yeah, this one just,
is just terrible.
It is pretty bad.
You walk out of Mamma Mia saying, I felt so good. No one is going to feel good. Like, ooh, Gauguin, way to go, buddy.
And, you know, we felt a little guilty. I expected something a little more of it because it was being marketed by really the major studio marketing teams here, and so I somehow thought that meant that it was going to be a little just a little better than your average one that might come through other channels, and I was really just disappointed to find that was not the case.
Yeah, I don't even want to talk about this movie anymore. This is just there was one movie we did not see this week, Unfriended Dark Web.
Oh, we did miss that.
Yes. I did not see the first Unfriended.
I didn't know there was a first Unfriended.
This is coming to theaters with a gimmick. It has two separate endings, and you don't know which one you're going to get per screening. It's random. So some theaters will have one ending, and other theaters will have a different ending.
Hmm. So are people supposed to just keep going to the screenings until they find one?
They will go to whatever screening they see, get their ending, and then just go online and see what the other ending was. And I think I wasn't you know, I was alive, but I didn't have conscious thought back then. I think Clue did that back in the day.
Maybe.
If any of you listening to this, tell me if Clue did that. But no, didn't see Unfriended, Dark Web. Now, I did tease before this, there was this major casting news, and then he walked into the house and he burst my bubble. Like, you already knew it. Yeah, you didn't know who was playing what character. And I've never said, you're a Broadway person.
Uh-huh.
I've been to Broadway, but I've never, like, I'm not the Broadway person you are. And I've never seen Cats. I don't know anything about Cats.
I'm just shocked and disappointed.
I know Memory. I know that song.
I'm going to dig out my Cats cast album and make you listen to it.
But we learned they're making a movie. They're going to adapt Cats into this, you know, new Hollywood feature film. And they're talking about casting. Three names have popped up. They said the first one you mentioned was Taylor Swift. It's going to play, I can't even pronounce the name, like Brombolina or something. Jennifer Hudson. It's going to play
Grisabella. And, I can totally see that.
Old Deuteronomy is going to be Ian McKellen.
I completely can see that. And that reminds me that one thing I did want to point out about Blindspotting is that the success of Hamilton, I think, really will help this film, will help make it a little more mainstream accessible, that there is this layer of spoken word rap that kind of pops into various, the most poignant scenes. They kind of reverse engineered the script a little bit to work with some of the spoken verse. And David Diggs won a Tony for his role in Hamilton. And so I think a lot of the Hamilton fans will find Blindspotting for that reason and embrace it way more than they otherwise might have. But there was some other casting news you mentioned.
And that one too. I wasn't really even excited about. But they're already shooting Top Gun 2, and yet they're still casting it. And it looks like the love interest this time, this 2019's Kelly McGillis, is going to be Jennifer Connelly. Uh-huh. Jennifer Connelly is going to go, here's one for you. This is my tease for next week. This one just stings. Tomorrow night, we're going to go to the National Air and Space Museum, and we're going to see
Mission Impossible. What is this one
Fallout.
Called?
Mission Fallout. Impossible Fallout. And I saw Tom Cruise in Mission Impossible Fallout. Is 5 years older than Wilford Brimley was in Cocoon.
That is amazing. That is amazing. To which my response is, you know, 50-ish is the new 30-ish. So
Wilford
thank
Brimley
God
was
for that.
Born old.
That is amazing. I think he was. Because that is quite the statistic. And
it makes me feel just wrong.
But there's that whole Tom Cruise connection going on. Then you've got your Top Gun casting news. And we're about to go see Mission Impossible. And I did, I was watching something the other day where Henry Cavill was saying how they all got a kick during the filming of Mission Impossible, where there was a scene where a bunch of jets were flying in formation and Tom Cruise was sort of spouting all of his Top Gun lines. Ugh. And it really just made for a fun day on set. And so I think that now when I go in to watch Mission Impossible tomorrow, I'm going to be looking for whatever that scene might have been and probably superimpose my own memories of all these lines from Top Gun on that.
All right, fair enough. Quick recap, because I don't think we actually did that yet. Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again. Yeah, call me dumbfounded. It's not bad.
It's fun. It's
Lily James.
Yeah, Lily James is great. It's it's completely forgettable in a few weeks, but the songs are so memorable that I just challenge anyone not to just kind of come out of that movie humming something, whether it's Waterloo, SOS, or I Kissed the Teacher.
The Equalizer 2. No way. It's just boring. It's poorly written. Talk about forgettable.
I'm sorry to hear that, but I think if you really are a fan of Denzel Washington and a fan of the first one, you won't hate going into this one. I think you just will kind of be like, that was okay.
Eighth Grade starts our bet. I'm going to put my money on Eighth Grade being the longer awards conversation horse over Blindspotting. I just connected with Kayla up and down. You go, Elsie Fisher.
I'm going to say the reverse because you haven't seen Blindspotting. And I think once you see Blindspotting, you will understand why it deserves to be right up there, if not ahead of Eighth Grade in the buzz category.
Dark Money. No, it won't be nominated for anything. It's probably just a good PBS film. But some of us, other than others of us, will really connect with this film and recognize campaign finance is a problem in this country.
I think everyone knows campaign finance is a problem in this country, and so all this does is remind you, but the people who need to be reminded most will never see or hear about this film.
A film that no one should ever see nor hear about is Gauguin, Voyage to Tahiti. Talk about the ultimate Disney villain.
Well, Artie Chick wrote the review for this one for chickflix.net, which was the appropriate way to go. And her advice, and I completely concur, is voyage on over to a museum instead and look at the guy's paintings and don't bother looking at this film.
Yeah, if you know more about him, like, it's going to affect the way you look at those paintings.
Absolutely.
13. All right. Thank you very much for listening to the Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell.
I'm Hannah Buchdahl.
Thank you.
Take care.
Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah is presented twice each weekend at RadioSt.Pete.com at 5:15 Eastern on Saturday and 9:15 on Sunday mornings. Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net. Listen again for Cinema Clash on RadioSt.Pete.com.